Undaunted, a Stan Turner Mystery, Volume 1 by William Manchi, read by Jeffrey Kafer and Erica Escalona. To my wife, Janet. Chapter 1. Love, War, and Politics, Fall 1967. The one thing great about going to college is the opportunity for a fresh start. When you step on the college campus for the first time, nobody there knows you, so you get a chance to redefine yourself. That was particularly important for me, as high school had been a major disappointment on so many different levels. I wasn't a jock, nor was I popular, and I wasn't an intellectual by any stretch of the imagination. Any success I had enjoyed came strictly from hard work and sheer determination. Consequently, high school hadn't been a pleasant experience, so I was glad when I walked onto the UCLA campus. Much to my delight, the students in college were much more mature and treated me with a respect and dignity that I'd never before experienced. It felt good, and I began to make friends, go out on dates, and get involved in campus life. In fact, when it came time to elect officers for my dorm, someone nominated me for treasurer, and I actually got elected. During my second year, I moved out of the dorm and into an apartment with my friend Steve. This provided much more privacy and freedom and allowed us to invite girls over and have parties. It was in my junior year that I met Rebecca James, and my life changed forever. It was the first week of school, and I needed to take a fine arts course for my political science degree. I decided the history of art was my best bet. I had no particular interest in art, but I figured a little knowledge in that area might come in handy for cocktail banter, if nothing else. It was a Friday afternoon in October when I strolled into the large auditorium in which the 350 students met twice a week for class. I walked down the aisle toward the front of the auditorium looking for a seat. My preference was to be close to the stage so I could hear better and get a good look at the slides that were usually projected on the large screen set up behind the professor. Scanning the available seats, I noticed an empty one next to a cute brunette in an orange blouse and brown skirt, diligently studying some handwritten notes. Feeling an immediate attraction to her, I claimed the seat next to her and sat down. We exchanged glances, but neither of us said anything. Finally, I marshaled my courage and broke the ice. "Hi, how's it going?" I said cheerily. She glanced over at me again and smiled. She had big brown eyes that were enhanced by a slender face. "Hello, not too bad," she replied. "I'm Stan." "Nice to meet you, Stan. I'm Rebecca." "So are you an art major?" I asked. "Yes, how did you know?" I looked into her eyes and felt a rush of excitement. There was something about her that lit a spark in me. Smiling broadly, I answered her question. "From the looks of your notebook, it appears you're pretty serious about this course." She laughed and shook her head. "Oh, well, actually, these are my roommate's notes. She took the course last semester. I'd like to get a preview of what's going to be covered during each class. It makes it much easier to keep up. Dr. Breckenridge moves pretty fast." "That's for sure. She lost me the first day." She smiled and looked back at her notebook, obviously hinting that I should leave her to her preparation. But I didn't care. She was so enchanting. I wanted to get to know her. "I guess you must really like art?" She looked up and politely replied, "I love it." "Huh. I never paid much attention to it before, but I am starting to like it." She nodded. "The more you learn about it, the more fascinating it becomes. I'm just amazed at what some of the great masters could do. I wish I could paint, but I'm afraid I don't have any talent for it." As we continued to talk, my initial excitement grew to exhilaration. Rebecca made me feel alive, better than I could ever remember. Suddenly, I became keenly interested in this most remarkable young lady sitting next to me. She had beautiful, soft skin, a firm body, a smell that was intoxicating. I wanted her phone number. I had to have her phone number. "What's your major?" she asked. "Poli-sci." "What are you going to do with a degree in political science?"
"I'm going to go to law school if I can get in."
"Oh, really? That sounds exciting. What kind of law do you want to practice?" she asked.
"I don't know. Actually, I want to go into politics."
"Really?"
"Uh-huh."
"What made you get interested in politics?"
I shrugged. I don't know. Politics just excites me. I guess it's like you and art.
Huh.
So where are you from? I asked.
Portland, Oregon.
You're a long way from home.
Quite a ways.
I'm from Ventura, just 60 miles up the coast.
Do you live at home?
No, I've got an apartment in Westwood with my friend Steve. Where are you staying?
In a dorm.
Just then the professor walked in and struck her pointer on the podium to get our attention. I raised my eyebrows and turned to listen. If anyone had asked me what the professor had covered in class that day, I couldn't have told them. Rebecca had completely destroyed my concentration. After class, we walked outside.
Listen, I'd like to see you again. Maybe I could buy you dinner? I said.
Rebecca smiled.
Well, Stan, I appreciate the offer, but I've got a boyfriend.
Oh, no. I sighed, not trying to hide my disappointment.
How could you do that to me?
Rebecca laughed.
We can still be friends, right? I really enjoy talking to you. Is that okay?
Okay, I replied unenthusiastically. I'll see you later, then. It was apparent to me that there was little hope of ever striking up a relationship with Rebecca, since no man in his right mind would ever let a woman like that go. But I sensed we had connected a little bit in our first conversation, and I didn't want to just blow her off at this point. Every day for most of the semester, I made a point of sitting with her. We got to know each other quite well, and began to confide in each other like friends do. It was wonderful hearing about her family and the things that were going on in her life, but also utterly frustrating that I couldn't put my arms around her and show her how I felt. Fortunately, one day I got lucky. As I was walking toward art class, I saw Rebecca and her boyfriend engaged in a heated discussion. When they were done, he stormed off and Rebecca was left crying incessantly. I went over to her to try to comfort her.
"Rebecca, what happened?"
I asked gently.
"That stupid son of a bitch can rot in hell as far as I'm concerned."
I stifled a laugh. "Oh, what did he do?"
"I saw him kissing and fondling some slut on the drill team last night."
"Oh, my God," I said as I silently thanked him for this miracle.
"And he has the nerve to think he can just come up to me and say he was sorry and that it didn't mean anything? Well, I told him it meant something to me. It meant he and I were through."
"I don't blame you. When you make a commitment, it should be sacred." Rebecca looked at me warmly and smiled.
"I'm sorry, Stan. You must think I'm terrible carrying on this way."
No, it's good to get your emotions out. I only wish I could do something for you."
"Thank you, but there's nothing you can do about a scumbag like that."
"Listen, you probably don't feel much like going to class, I bet."
"Not really."
"I wouldn't mind skipping class today either. We can study your roommate's notes later." Rebecca wiped the tears from her eyes and nodded approvingly. "Why don't we go get a Coke? Maybe I can get your mind off what happened."
"That would be nice."
"Okay then, let's go." That was it. The break I needed. From then on, Rebecca looked at me differently. I could see it in her eyes. I was becoming more than just a friend. One day, several weeks later, after I'd walked her back to her dorm, she kissed me like it was the most natural thing in the world to do. I put my arms around her and nearly crushed her, I was so happy. After that, we did a lot of kissing and other things young lovers do. But we didn't make love. Rebecca was a good Catholic girl and insisted on being a virgin on her wedding day. That was okay with me since we'd have the rest of our lives to do our lovemaking. Assuming she'd marry me, which I desperately wanted. My only problem was money. I was absolutely broke. My parents were barely making a living and pretty much had told me once I graduated from high school that I was on my own. Luckily, I was able to get a small scholarship from the Rotary Club, a couple of student loans, and was able to find two part-time jobs to make ends meet while at UCLA. That was fine for me, but hardly enough to support a wife, so I decided not to divulge my intentions to Rebecca just then. My main job while I was in school was in the varsity bookstore in the student union. My hours were from 3 to 7, Monday through Friday. It was a decent job, but didn't pay enough for me to survive. After many trips to the job placement office, in the spring of 1968, I found another part-time job from 6 to 8 every morning, Monday through Saturday. It was a plush restaurant and sidewalk cafe in Westwood called Michaela's Place. My job there was to hose down the patio and clean all the leaves and bird droppings off the tables that invariably accumulated each night. Michaela's place was owned and operated by Miguel Sanchez and his wife, Michaela. They were wonderful people, and I got to know them quite well. Each morning when I was about finished with my work, Michaela would come out and talk to me. She would sometimes have additional tasks for me or offer me some constructive criticism about my work, but most of the time she just liked to talk. She was the daughter of a farm worker who spent most of his life moving around Southern California from one harvest to another, trying to scrape out a living for his large family. It was a cruel and bitter life, but fortunately Michaela had been able to attend one public school or another and managed to get a high school diploma. Armed with this education and the pride and confidence it provided her, she was able to get a job as a waitress at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. Being an attractive, intelligent, and ambitious woman, she quickly earned the respect and admiration of the hotel management. They rewarded her with greater responsibility and longer hours, but no significant increase in compensation. When Michaela met Miguel, she was depressed and frustrated with her life. She knew she was another victim of white racism. She saw her less talented Caucasian colleagues get pay raises and promotions while she struggled at minimum wage. She felt hopeless and alone. She dreamed of owning her own restaurant. Then one day she was sent to pick up some linen from a local laundry company that had been inadvertently left off the regular delivery. The company was one of only a handful in L.A., owned by a Mexican-American. She entered the busy little enterprise, not sure exactly where to go or whom to see. It was very noisy, so her verbal attempts at getting help were ineffective. Seeing a young man with a clipboard giving instructions to a group of workers, she tapped him on the shoulder. The young man turned out to be the owner's son, Miguel Sanchez. When Miguel saw her, he was mesmerized. Not only was she pretty, but she was smart and ambitious. They hit it off immediately and began to date. In time, they fell in love and after 8 months of courtship, got married. Miguel loved Michaela very much and wanted to help her fulfill her dream of opening a restaurant, so he convinced his father to back her. On July 4, 1949, she opened Michaela's place in Westwood. The restaurant was so successful, Miguel had to quit his job and help Michaela run it. About 18 months later, Michaela gave birth to a son, Thomas. They both loved Thomas very much and spoiled him. This caused a problem because Michaela didn't want to leave Thomas to go to work every day, so Miguel built a nursery at the restaurant where they were able to keep him happy during the day. One day, during one of our chats, I told Michaela all about Rebecca. She insisted that I bring her over to meet them on one particular Saturday. We arrived at the appointed hour and were warmly greeted.
"Come, sit down. Can I offer you some coffee or tea?"
Michaela asked. "Some coffee would be great," I said. Michaela brought over coffee for everyone and sat down.
"Stan has told me a lot about you, Rebecca."
"Oh, really?"
"Yes, he says you love art."
"Yes, I do," Rebecca agreed. "I love art, too. I wish I could have studied it like you."
Rebecca smiled.
"It is fascinating, but you don't have to study it to enjoy it."
"That's definitely true."
Rebecca gazed at the ornately furnished room curiously.
"Did you decorate this place yourself?" Rebecca asked.
"Oh, yes. Miguel and I did it many years ago."
"Well, you did a fine job. Your restaurant is absolutely charming. I love it."
"Thank you. Decorating is something I learned working at the Ambassador Hotel when I was very young."
"So Stan says you have a son?" Rebecca said.
"Yes, we have a 17-year-old son, Thomas,"
Michaela replied.
"Oh, does he still live at home?"
"No, he's in the Marine Corps in Vietnam right now, a place called Khe Sanh."
"Oh, you must be very proud of him."
"Yes, he's a fine boy."
"What does he do in the Marines?"
"He's in the infantry."
"Did he want to go into the Marines or was he drafted?"
"He enlisted."
"Oh, I bet you must worry a lot about him."
"Yes, I pray for him every day. There is not an hour that passes that I don't think about him and wish that he were home with me."
"Maybe the war will be over soon and he'll come back home."
"I hope so."
"So, Miguel, were you a Marine?" I asked.
"Yes, during World War II I was stationed in the Philippines for a while and then on the Canary Islands."
"So Thomas wanted to follow in his father's footsteps, I guess."
"Yes, he's always dreamed of being a Marine."
We talked for some time until I glanced at my watch and noticed it was getting late.
"Well, it's been nice talking to both of you. Rebecca and I have to get going here pretty soon. I've got to go to a campaign strategy meeting and Rebecca has a term paper that's due tomorrow."
Oh, what campaign? Michaela asked.
Nixon, I said, hoping she wasn't a Democrat. I'm his campus spokesman.
Good, he's a fine man, Michaela said.
That he is, I replied. Well, thanks for inviting us over.
You're welcome, Miguel said.
After leaving Michaela and Miguel, I went to the Nixon meeting, and Rebecca went back to her dorm. Ever since I was 12 years old, I had been intrigued with politics and thought that was ultimately the career I wanted to pursue. I knew most politicians were attorneys, so I set my sights on that goal first. Politics would come later. My first summer out of high school, I was lucky enough to be selected as a congressional intern for Congressman Charles Harmon. During that summer, I met a lot of influential people and got a real taste of politics. When I came to UCLA, I joined the Young Republicans, and when Nixon announced he was running for president, I was appointed chairman of UCLA Youth for Nixon. In the fall of 1968, the campus newspaper was sponsoring a candidates forum designed to educate the students on the candidates and issues of the 1968 presidential campaign. I was invited to speak on behalf of the Nixon campaign. The forum was to be outdoors in front of the campus newspaper office. A large podium was erected with large speakers on both sides. In most years, a crowd for this type of event would be small, but since the Vietnam War was not going well and anti-war protesters were focusing much of their activities on college campuses, I wasn't sure what to expect. On the day of the event, Rebecca and Steve came to watch my speech. I met them at the library 20 minutes before the forum was to start.
"Well, are you ready, Mr. Politician?" Steve teased.
"Ready as I'll ever be," I replied.
"Do you think many people will show up?" Rebecca asked.
"Probably not. You know how apathetic people usually are." As we reached the long descent that led from Central Campus down to the Student Union, we were stunned by the mass of humanity that stood before us.
"What in the blazes is this?" Steve said.
"Geez, I don't know," I replied, taking in the unexpected sight.
"You sure this is the right place? It looks more like a rock concert," Rebecca noted.
"No, this is the right place," I replied. "It must be some kind of political demonstration."
"What's that smell?"
Rebecca asked, sniffing the air. Steve took in a deep breath.
It smells like love weed."
"Love weed?" she questioned.
"Yeah, marijuana. Have you ever tried it?"
"No," she replied indignantly.
"Have you?"
"Just a drag or two to see what it was like," Steve admitted. "I wonder where all these people came from," I said. "They can't all be students." As we walked toward our destination, we caught sight of the podium in front of the office of the Daily Bruin. For a moment, the significance of that didn't register with me. Then I swallowed hard.
"Oh, God, this is the audience for the presidential forum," I said.
"Shucks, and you forgot your bulletproof vest," Steve said, half seriously.
"I don't like this," Rebecca said warily. "These people are creepy."
"Well, I can't quit now. It would look pretty bad if the Nixon representative bailed out just because a few hippies showed up to debate presidential politics."
"You've always wanted to be a martyr, haven't you?" Steve asked.
As we approached the podium, Steve and Rebecca walked to the front of the crowd to listen to the presentations. I climbed up on the podium and looked around for a familiar face. A representative from the Daily Bruin saw me and walked over.
"Hi, Stan. Quite a crowd, isn't it?"
"Who are these people? Surely they're not students."
"No, I think they were bussed in from Venice Beach. The anti-war movement decided our campaign forum was a good target for a protest."
"Do you think they'll get violent?"
"No, they are usually peaceful demonstrations. Don't worry."
"Yeah, that's easy for you to say. You're not going out on the podium to endorse an expansion of the Vietnam War to 10,000 anti-war protesters."
"You wanted to be a politician, didn't you?"
I laughed. "Well, until now, I thought it would be fun."
"This is your chance to make a name for yourself. You've got 10,000 people who will be hanging on every word you say, plus national media coverage."
My pulse quickened.
"National media coverage?"
"Yeah, right over there. NBC, ABC, CBS, and UPI.
"Oh my God!" A sinking feeling quickly overcame me. Giving a speech before a small audience was bad enough, but this was overwhelming. I started to go over my speech in my mind, but I had a complete lapse of memory. My instincts told me to run. I'd say I got sick. The smell of marijuana made me nauseated. Okay, the Humphrey rep is on first, then you're up. Good luck.
Thanks a lot.
Linda Carmichael, a black activist, gave the remarks for the Humphrey campaign, which were warmly received by the left-wing crowd. As her speech drew to a close, I spotted a small contingent of Nixon supporters trying to work their way up toward the podium. They were waving their Nixon Now signs above their heads, but were being jostled around by the Beat Nixon hippies around them. When Ms. Carmichael was done, the crowd jumped to their feet and gave her a standing ovation. Now it was my turn. As I looked out upon the vast sea of hostile faces, my legs began to quiver. I looked over at Rebecca and saw her scrutinizing the crowd nervously. Then the master of ceremonies took the mic and began to introduce me.
Ladies and gentlemen, the UCLA Daily Bruin is proud to introduce the spokesman for the Nixon campaign on campus, Stanley Turner, who will present the policies and platform of presidential candidate Richard M. Nixon.
The crowd, which had not sat down from their standing ovation given to Ms. Carmichael, began to boo and then started chanting, "Peace now! Peace now! Peace now!" I took the podium and waited for the crowd to quiet down, but the chanting just got louder. The master of ceremonies came over and asked the crowd for silence, but to no avail. I began speaking anyway.
"You all claim to be the champions of freedom, liberty, and the Constitution, yet you trample on the First Amendment. You want the citizens of this great nation to listen to your cries for peace, but you turn your ears away from those seeking to engage in rational debate."
The crowd began to quiet down, except for a few hecklers.
223 American soldiers died yesterday,"
a heckler yelled. "That is certainly a great tragedy, and is the very reason you should elect Richard M. Nixon president. As you will recall, it was Democrat Lyndon Johnson's overreaction to the Gulf of Tonkin incident that got us into this war. But now that we are there, we should finish the job we started."
"Nixon is a fascist pig,"
another heckler yelled. "What we need to do is turn the military loose to launch an all-out effort to win the war. That's the only way we can get this war over quickly and bring our soldiers home." The crowd went berserk.
"Murderer!
Go back to Germany, you Nazi scum!"
"Peace now! Peace now! Peace now!" the crowd chanted in unison. The TV cameras zoomed in as the crowd began to dance to the chant of "Peace now." Two pretty young women in matching short skirts jumped on the stage and stood on each side of me. I looked over at the master of ceremony, who just shrugged. The girls had matching blue and gold Bruin jackets, which they were holding firmly over their bosoms. When the noise of the crowd was able to subside, the two girls pulled open their jackets, exposing their naked breasts with the words "Peace Now" painted on them. The crowd cheered, and I couldn't help but laugh until the two girls moved in on both sides of me for the cameras. Before I knew it, the cameras were flashing. A trifle miffed, I tried to make a hasty retreat, but the girls had me firmly in their grasps. Finally, I just smiled for the cameras. It angered me that the demonstrators had managed to disrupt our debate, cut short my presentation, and make it look like I was part of their protest, but I knew what had happened that day wouldn't matter much in the end. Their efforts would do nothing but strengthen Nixon's resolve to bring the Viet Cong to their knees and show the American people that his policies had been correct all along. The next day I was shocked and embarrassed to see myself on the front page of the Daily Bruin, sandwiched between the two naked hippies. Steve thought the whole affair was hilarious, and I think he was a little jealous. Rebecca, on the other hand, said it was a good thing she'd been there to witness the entire spectacle, because she never in a million years would have believed my explanation of how I'd managed to get photographed, sandwiched between two naked girls.